rend a fire, un instrumento.
Okay, good evening, everyone. So we take advantage of the... So we take advantage a little bit of the interactivity in the media. You can click on the links. A little Eufen Pripachik, that old Yiddish lullaby, which might be the soundtrack, let's say, for tonight's discussion, which is, last time we discussed what European Jewry was like. No, I'm sorry, last time we discussed what is modern Jewish history? When does it begin? What are the characteristics of modern Jewish history? What are the characteristics of modernity altogether? And how and when do Jews enter that period? What are the stop signs along the way that indicate that somehow we've moved from pre-modern society to modern society? Obviously, again, it didn't all happen in one fell swoop on one day. And today we're going to talk a little bit about what was Jewish culture, civilization, society like in the pre-modern era, on the eve of the pre-modern era, in Europe, of course. The links to these YouTube videos, if you search Eufen on YouTube, you'll find links to different editions of this great lullaby. I just sent you a link. Eufen Pripachik, of course, it literally means in Yiddish, by the fireside. It's a kind of nostalgic rendering of the image of the Malamed, the teacher, sitting by the fireside, teaching Aleph Beis to the children. I sent out by email a copy of this great Yiddish story translated into English. I hope that we'll have a chance to talk about it by the end of the evening. If not, then we'll do it next time. If you haven't had a chance to read it, then you might yet still have a chance. It's pretty short reading. What was Jewish life like in Europe? So when we ask about Jewish life in Europe in the 17th, even 18th centuries, we're talking about the Jews of Europe who are under a Christian society. And that relationship between the Jewish society and the Christian society is the all-important, all-defining. And it can't, of course, be divorced from its larger theological questions of what Judaism is in relation to that larger host society. Throughout most of the medieval period, the concept was largely one of, with many exceptions to the rule, but it was largely one of limited tolerance, and even though the theory was that the Christian society was tolerant of the Jews amongst them, in reality, history often differs from theory. Throughout much of that period, the church was guided by this verse from the Book of Psalms. We know it as a pasuk in Tehillim. The context of the verse, it might be worthwhile to look it up, because it could be the church is, of course, taking it out of context. That pasuk, Al tahargem pen yishkechu ami, hani'amo b'chelcha v'horidemu Manigenu Hashem. Don't kill them. don't the churches saying, again, we're darshaning the pasuk according to the church theology, as it were. Don't kill them, the Jews, lest my people forget. Remove them from their possessions with your power, God, and bring them down. Hori demo. Bring them down. That the Jews should not be killed, they should be tolerated, but they have to occupy a different position vis-a-vis the larger society. There has to be a clear sense that they, the Jews, are not like us, the Christians. And there are all types of rules that govern how and where Jews can live, and, you know, we saw last time at different periods what they could wear, how they might be identified, what occupations they could occupy, in order to be clear that they would be, separate, distinct, lower than the larger Jewish society. And throughout much of the medieval period, there were different points in different places where Jews actually had to live, of course, in the ghetto. Now, one of the interesting things about Jewish history is that it's given us a wealth of rich vocabulary, words that are coined in different European languages and pass into English. Words like Holocaust and ghetto, these are all words that have their origins, in Jewish history. This map of different Jewish ghettos, you can see a larger version of it. You can download just the map itself from our Shir homepage, which is useful to see. But the Judengasse, or the Jewish ghetto, before 1789, Jews were, again, largely isolated from their European neighbors. Even though the Jews in Europe go back, certainly in certain parts of Europe, go back many, 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 many centuries. The earliest, Jewish settlements amongst Christian Europe probably date to the 4th century. But the Christian society was always interested in, making it clear that the Jews were different, that they were not equal, neither in status nor in their economic position or in their political position or in their security position. Tehila Leah asks an interesting question, which we'll come back to. And it is precisely, this is it. In other words, the ghettos, whether they were walled cities or they were areas where the Jews lived in isolation from larger society, never completely cut off, because there was always some form of commerce going on. But in terms of day-to-day interaction, the ghettos meant not only Jewish isolation, but also Jewish autonomy. There was a sense of, in medieval society, of what was known as corporativism, that the society was divided up into separate, very often autonomous bodies, corporations, as it were, not in the contemporary sense of IBM, but corporate, of individual bodies, not of individuals. If the innovation of 1789, if the innovation of 1776 that we discussed last time was the recognition that the individual has sovereign rights, this is an innovation at the end of the 18th century, because before it, there really is no such notion as an individual, as an autonomous being who is entitled to rights. Your rights, the rights of any individual, were invested in him based upon what rung he occupied in part of a larger group, and that plays into the feudal system that existed, where there were clear hierarchies and everybody understood where they sat on the ladder. that feudal system, which comes about in the 8th century, in the 9th century in Europe, has the king at the top, who rules with the divine right of kings, and he, the king, decentralizes responsibilities and concomitant rights that go along with responsibilities that he can't perform. In other words, in theory, the king is the king of the entire kingdom, and he's in control of everything. But in reality, since that's not always something which is possible to execute over too large an area, so he has to divvy out responsibilities to other people, and therefore he also has to divvy out rights to other people to get them to do what he needs them to do. So, for example, there'll be a baron who will collect tolls and send a percentage up to the king. And this leads to different small corporate units within the kingdom, the manor, the parish, the town, the guild, even the university. The European universities are part of this. Everything is incorporated based upon the blessing, the imprimatur of the king, who in theory stands at the head of everything. Even think of cultural institutions. Can anybody think of a medieval cultural institution that still probably bears, I would like to think, some meaning in the modern world, in our modern Western culture, but which existed as an organ of the throne? I'm thinking about England specifically. Can anybody think of an example like this? Right? I'm thinking of Shakespeare's Theatre Company was incorporated by the throne. They were meant to be the theater company for Queen Elizabeth. And the fact that other people could buy tickets and go see it was incidental to the fact that they were incorporated as a theater company with the imprimatur of the British royal throne. In the 18th century, at least in Western Europe, there were about 400,000 Jews. There were about 400,000 Jews in Western Europe in the 18th century. They can't be organized into the feudal society because since we were not part of the Christian society, since we couldn't swear oaths of fealty, we can't get in through the normal ladder. But we can't be dealt with as individuals, since there's no such concept. So therefore, the Jewish communities were given a certain amount of autonomy, a certain amount of leeway to be self-governing. And this was really, generally speaking, considered to be a pretty good deal for the Jews. Because as long as this type of tolerance, this minimal amount of tolerance held out, and there weren't pogroms, another great word added to the lexicon from Jewish history, pogrom, as long as there weren't pogroms or the Crusades or other things that happened along the way, this kind of worked pretty well, that the Jews were left to their own to govern themselves as a corporate entity unto themselves, granted that right under the king. And the Jewish communities developed all different types of institutions to govern itself. Sherry asks me a question about Jewish population, the Jewish percentage of the total population. I don't have a figure. I'm sure a second of Googling, you can find it on your own. But it was pretty small. It was probably never more than 0.5% or so, or 1%. But what happened was that the Jews lived in dense concentrations. So if you knew one Jew, if you saw one Jew, you probably saw lots of Jews. So depending upon where you lived, you, the non-Jew, either you didn't know any Jews, or they were probably all over the place because of them living in living in close proximity. Kind of like going to Borough Park, Tikkurileya points out. In the Jewish communities, in the Jewish self-governed communities, there were different there were these different institutions. The educational institution, of course, most famously was the Cheder, or the Talmud Torah. These were small, hard to call them schools. They were for boys only. Generally speaking, boys were sent to school to learn reading and writing, Chumash, Mishnah. Others would progress further depending upon their family status, their financial abilities. But the idea that everybody went on to higher Torah education was obviously not the case. And only the talented and promising went on to higher Torah education. By higher Torah education, I mean, let's say, high school age. After that, you went and you became, apprenticed to the shoemaker or to the milkman or to whatever it was. The judicial governance of the community was done by the local Batei Din, the local Jewish courts that really. I see we're quoting pasuk and verse from the Fiddler soundtrack. Right at 3 I started Hebrew school. At 10 I learned a trade. I hear they picked a bride for me. I hope she's pretty. I think that's the snippet of the song you're looking for. The Batei Din were in charge of governing the community. They made gzeirot, they made takanot, they passed internal legislation that rules and regulations beyond, of course, their role in implementing and interpreting halakha, but the governance of the community. The most important tool of the of the community is, of course, cherem. Is cherem. We know about cherem today. If you do something, if somebody writes a book that has ideas that are deemed to be of questionable provenance, so the rabbonim will put a cherem on the book, or maybe even on its author, literally to excommunicate them. But it's not something that has the same type of teeth it once did. In the medieval ages, cherem was an extremely powerful punishment, and the threat of it alone was enough to really to keep everyone in line. Anybody have any speculation for why that is? Why cherem in the pre-modern period was so powerful? What would happen if you were put... Right, so Sherry is right, the community was everything in their lives, but why? It's not just that others couldn't do business with you. What did you lose if you were put in cherem? Yeah, bidiyuk. Nowhere else to go. In other words, you're losing your connection to the community would be dramatic because the community is your whole life. But again, as an individual in medieval Europe, you don't exist. You have no rights at all. You have no protections at all. Whatever rights you have, the very right to live in your house, on that land, which belongs to the king, is granted to you by charter through the community. That's why the Jewish communities, we have these pinkasim, the pinkasim, the census lists of the communities. Because if you got married, it was written in the book, and if you had children, they were written in the book, and if you get into harem, we cross your name out, and that's precisely what happens. That's precisely what happens in one of the most famous haramim of this period, to Spinoza, to Baruch Spinoza. Spinoza, philosopher, a European philosopher of great note in the 17th century, lives from 1632 to 1677 in Amsterdam. He's part of the Sephardic Jewish community in Amsterdam. The Sephardic Jewish community in Amsterdam was made up largely of exiles from Spain at the end of the 15th century, and conversos, moranos, Jews that were in hiding, who then get out of the Iberian Peninsula and make their way to Amsterdam. There are other communities that become centers of the exiles from Spain, but Amsterdam is one of them. Spinoza was a philosopher who, had some ideas which were really contravened conventional Jewish philosophical notions. And after various warnings, he was put into excommunication, into Cherem, on July 27, 1656. And this is the text, in English, of course, of the Cherem, of the decree that was signed by the leaders of the community, the seigneurs of the Mahamad. This is Mahamad, the Mahamad, the committee of scholars that are passing the Cherem against Spinoza, because they've been long aware, being cognizant of the wrong opinions and behavior of Baruch de Spinoza. Right? His behavior is not in accord with halakha, but perhaps even more significant, his opinions that he possesses, disseminates, teaches heretical ideas. And they've tried various means and premises to dissuade him from his evil ways, but as they effected no improvement, obtaining, on the contrary, more information every day of the horrible heresies which he practiced and taught, and of the monstrous actions which he performed, and as they had many trustworthy witnesses who, in the presence of Spinoza, reported and testified against him and convicted him, etc., etc., etc. So they decide that Spinoza should be excommunicated and separated from the people of Israel. Now, when it says separated from the people of Israel, they don't mean that he's not a Jew. On the contrary, we operate under the principle as outlined in the Gemara in Sanhedrin and elsewhere, Yisrael afal pi shechata Yisrael hu, that there's no way out, that if you are Jewish, no matter how sinful you are, even if somebody were to convert to a different religion, that there's no such thing really in Judaism. We don't recognize that as having any legitimacy. You're still a Jew in the eyes of the Jewish community. So when the Cherem says that he's separated from the people of Israel, it doesn't mean that he's not a Jew. It means that he's no longer a member of the community, and therefore he's on his own. It's like being blasted out into outer space. He's suddenly adrift in a society where it's impossible to exist as an individual. You only exist insofar as you're a member of some kind of corporate entity, and that's why the case of Spinoza, notwithstanding, the case of Spinoza, notwithstanding, cherim was usually a very, very, very effective stick by which to keep everyone in line. The section here is the actual text of the cherim. It follows a certain traditional nusach, a traditional formula about the judgment of the angels and the saints. It's a kind of flowery way of saying that they were about to do what we're about to do. And it includes the results are that nobody should communicate with him orally or in writing, show him any favor, stay with him under the same roof, come within arba amot, within four meters of him, or read anything composed or written by him. Of course, that's the most significant because they sensed a danger in these heretical teachings of Spinoza. So it's not just that they wanted to punish him, they wanted to isolate him from everyone else. So that's the second kind of characteristic of the Jewish community. The first being the education, the second being the Batei Din, and the third being a whole network of social welfare. In other words, if the cherem and the Batei Din is the stick, then the carrot is the chesed and the charity and the tzedakah and the chevra kadisha and the gamach and all of the things, the tomchei shabbos and the tamchui, and all the manner in which the Jewish community cared for itself and for its own, to take care of the sick, to take care of the widow, to take care of the orphan, to help the poor, etc., etc., etc. These were very, very, very well organized institutions that were part of the community. So because of this, the center of Jewish life becomes the Batei Knesset, becomes the shul, and the general government really doesn't interfere all that much. Let me just look at these questions. Was his writing truly radical religious theory at the time? No, I think that if you look at Spinoza's writing was indeed heretical, the divinity of the Torah, but even about God. In other words, just briefly stated, and you know, if you look him up in the encyclopedia, you can round out your education. Essentially, he doesn't deny that there's a type of God, but he identifies God more as a type of a natural force, let's say, instead of the kind of conventional personal God that we tend to think of in Judaism and in most of the great religions. So he's put into cherem in 1656. His name is literally crossed out in the community register, as if, I mean, lahavdil elef alfei havdalot, in Orwellian terms, he becomes a non-person. An un-person. The cherem, you know, itself, of course, it's more effective than any police force. There is no police force in the ghetto, per se. Did the community feed? No, the community didn't do anything with the person. The person in the cherem didn't exist. They were gone. They had to wander the earth. They had to get out. They had to leave their home. In theory, I mean, it didn't always work that way. But in theory, that's the way it was. The governing of the communities was generally a function of all of the male householders, the balebatim, who would elect the zakenim, the city elders. Those city elders would elect or appoint the rabbis, the tax collectors, the judges, the dayonim of the Batei Din, and they're the administrators of the Jewish community. the elders, these lay elders, these lay leaders, were generally viewed as oppressive figures, because they were also in charge of the tax collecting. Now remember, there's a double tax. The community has to kick up a certain amount to the king, but the community also has to levy a tax in order to run all of these institutions of the community. There's another characteristic, and that is what's called the court Jew. The court Jew was the representative of the Jewish community to the court, to the king, to the power. It's described very well in an excellent book called Out of the Ghetto by the great Jewish historian Jacob Katz. Katz died a couple of years ago. He was one of the very important teachers at the Hebrew University. He lived into a ripe old age, and all of his books are extraordinarily important for the understanding of, particularly, of this period. And this book, Out of the Ghetto, which I'm sure you can find on Amazon, I'm sure it's in print, I'm sure all of his books are still in print, describes the court Jew in the following way, and it really gives some insight to to life at the time. Let's just read it together. Is there somebody else that would like to read it? Who's there? Who has a microphone? Sherry, do you have a microphone? Hi, we can hear you.
I'm sorry. I have to run and get a knock on my door. I'll read it when I get back.
Okay, so we'll get somebody else to read first. Saul, are you with us? Hello, Saul? Okay, so I'll take it from here. Unless we can get somebody, some other brave soul. I think Saul's on the phone. We're going to mute him. So Katz writes, "The social ascent of the court Jew in 17th and 18th centuries has been pointed to as an undoubtedly new feature of Jewish society at that time. As a result of their important economic role, these rich Jews acquired positions of influence with those in power. The court Jew was always a rich Jew. He was always, he didn't become rich because he was a court Jew. He became a court Jew because he was rich." Now this is important because by the dawn of the modern era, during the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, the Jewish population in Europe, by and large, were really quite poor. There was tremendous poverty. The communities did a heroic job in trying to maintain some standard of living and trying to make sure that people didn't literally starve to death, to take care of their own, but there was really rampant poverty throughout European Jewry, although there were, of course, figures of immense wealth. The emperor, king, princes, and bishops whom they served were served by these rich Jews in that economic role. In return for their services, they often secured privileges for themselves. Some of them were exempted from paying the Schutzgeld, which was a type of a protection money, a type of tax. That was a basic condition of the Jews' right to toleration in certain places. The court Jew might also secure the right of residence for his family, his widow, or his sons-in-law, in places, let's say, in the city, outside of the restricted Jewish, the restricted Jewish areas, outside of the ghettos. So, for example, Berlin, we saw last time, Berlin was a city that, throughout most of its history, was off-limits to Jewish residents. Unless you were able to arrange a permit, and you didn't arrange a permit to be there unless you really had some type of what they call protectia. More than that, communities were founded or enlarged owing to the influence of a court Jew. In addition, court Jews were exempted from the jurisdiction of both Jewish and Gentile courts and were accountable for their actions only to the royal court, like other officials of the ruler. Indeed, the court Jew's status resembled that of a high officials in other respects as well. He was appointed to his post by his lord. He bore the title Hofactor or Hofagent and other similar titles and received a salary. Finally, the court Jew also demonstrates his high standing by outward appearance. He's clad, if not entirely in the fashion followed by one of the other states, then, in any case, differently from his Jewish brethren. In his household, his attire and equipage exhibit his wealth and influence. This type of Jew who acquires forbearance and standing by serving the politically powerful is no novelty in Jewish history. He's found wherever Jews live among Gentiles and relied on the protection of the mighty. Think of medieval Spain. Think of even the figure, let's say, of the Barbanel and the role that he played in the Spanish royal court. To serve the masters of the country with money and business acumen gave Jews their best chance to ascend beyond the level of the underprivileged. The Jewish financier and tax farmer of Muslim and Christian Spain are perhaps the most conspicuous examples of this. Still, the court Jews of the 17th and 18th centuries seem to have surpassed all their precursors. They were more numerous, their business activities were more extensive, their influence increased, so did their proximity to those in power. No wonder that historians came to regard them as prime movers in what was happening in Jewish society at the time. Between the Jewish community and the general community grows, there are always questions about what to do with these Jews. This is the proto-question, the prototype of the Jewish question, which will be answered by what, again, the Nazis thought was the final solution to the Jewish question. Of course, theirs, thank God, was not the final solution, but the penultimate solution, the final solution being that the Jews really don't belong here, and they need to be in their own place. That's my zip code. Some of you are still living elsewhere. But in the meantime, there were attempts to do other things, to extort the Jews, to try to tax them to death, to try to at different points to expel them. The theological problems of how we, the Christian society, can allow these infidels to live peaceably in our midst was from time to time answered with different types of persecution and anti-Semitism, subjecting Jews to humiliating restrictions and the like, taxes and badges and ghettos, etc., etc., etc. Again, these ghettos were usually really overcrowded. They were dirty. They were squalid. They were fire traps. They were breeding grounds of disease. Jews were only allowed to leave. In many cases, were only allowed to leave for business. They were not allowed to leave on Sundays or on other Christian holidays. After nightfall, the gates are locked, etc., etc., etc. This is the condition. This is the condition in Western Europe. In Eastern Europe, in Poland, what we call Poland, is not exactly what today we call Poland, because the borders of Poland expanded and contracted many times over the years. Poland itself was divided a number of times. Sometimes what we call Poland, for the purposes of Jewish history, is really talking about what today is the Ukraine, or on the eastern side, what's today part of Russia or of Lithuania, etc. The parameters of what Poland are and was are sometimes fluid, and of course, I mean, I don't like to make too much of a big deal of it, but we have somebody sitting in Poland with us right now, and he probably knows more about this than I do, I imagine. I don't know. In the old days, did you learn about this stuff in school, Joel?
Of course, we will learn about all the changes of the Polish, which were quite often during the probably last 1,000 years. So it's very difficult to say what was Poland like compared to what is Poland right now. Actually, it's not even half of that.
So, for the purposes of Poland, there are different legends and stories about how the Jews got to Poland. In other words, the Jews, apparently Jews, after the exile, went up to Rome, and they got up to the Rhine Valley in Germany, probably pretty early, 6th, 7th century, something like that. And only later did they start moving eastward towards Poland. In his collection called Sipure Agadot, Polin Sipure Agadot, the great author Agnon, Shai Agnon, has the following. Now, I sent you this story, this Yiddish story by Reisen to look at. And here we're looking at something from Agnon, and Agnon, of course, is a writer of stories. This is not so much a story as much as he's recording fables of how the Jews got to Poland. I won't read the whole thing. Well, it is Davar ze masoret agadahi. This is it's a legend. Shalula Poland. Right, Masoret hi biadenu mi avotenu shalula Poland. Our forebears. I imagine that most of us, I mean, raise your hand, if you know you are descendant on any side from a Polish Jew. I mean, everybody's hand should be going up.
Right.
Joel, you should raise your hand. I mean, unless you want to say you're not a descendant of a Polish Jew, that's just who you are, right? But we're all, you know, somehow or other. I mean, it'd be remarkable if any of us is like, I mean, unless there's a Sephardi amongst us. I don't know if there are any Sephardi amongst us, but if you're an Ashkenazi, so chances are somebody came from Poland. Unless you're like a Yeki, purebred on both sides. So this is the tradition. This is the tradition. This is the tradition that our forefathers that came from Poland had. Ra'u Yisrael sheharidifot nimshechot v'holchot v'atzarot mitchadshot u'ba'ot v'ashibur holech v'gadol malchut harasha gzerot gozeret gzera achar gzera ad shelo haita lahem tkuma l'soneihem shel Yisrael. Things were really bad. Where was it really bad? Wherever the Jews were before they got to Poland. But probably it's talking about Germany before the, or during the Crusades. That the non-Jews were persecuting us. Amdu al drachim v'shalu l'netivot olam. So we kind of packed our bags. We headed for the road and we looked around, wanting to know where to go. Eze derech yelchu ba'al matzu margoa l'nafsham. What path should we take that we should walk on, that we should find rest for our weary souls? So here's the legend. I mean, until now, it's not a legend. That's black on white history. The Jews, where they were being persecuted. Here's the legend. Nafal petek min hashamayim. A note fell from heaven. A kvittel, you know, like a little piece of paper. This idea of receiving divine instruction through notes that fall from heaven is a notion that will be picked up in the stories of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov and in other Hasidic tales. But it's a type of latter-day low-grade nevuah. The idea that we'll get direction from heaven, a note falls from the sky, and the note says, Lichu lepolin, go to Poland. V'yelchu v'yavo arza polin v'yitnu lemelech har zahav v'yikabel otam lehamelech b'chavod gadol. So they get to Poland and they bribe their way in. V'Hashem richem aleihem v'yiten otam lerachamim lifnei hamelech v'asarim. And things were okay. The king lets them live throughout the kingdom. They prosper and they flourish there. They're able to be Jewish. The king defends them against enemies, both foreign and domestic, I guess. And everything initially is okay. V'Hashem tziva otam et habracha v'yivracham ba'aretz. V'yatza lehem shem bagoyim. What does this remind you of? Does this... You know, in Agnon's telling of it, does it ring a bell? You know, for Agnon, everything always, you know, he's telling the story here, and he's also telling the story elsewhere. Is there a story that's echoing here? Is there an intertext that makes you think? No, the Jews are in trouble in one place. They come someplace else. The king is very nice to them. He says, make yourselves at home. Because of that, because of the Jews' presence, everything is good for the Jews, everything is good for the non-Jewish host society. Yeah, Yosef and Paro. So what's Agnon doing by weaving the... Again, Agnon doesn't invent this fable, but in his weaving of it, what's he trying to say? No, think, people. If in saying something about the Jews getting to Poland, he's intentionally trying to get us to hear the echoes of the Jews going to Mitzrayim, what's he trying to tell us about the history of the Jews in Poland? Yeah, that, in other words, that ultimately there's going to be some problem. I don't know if he's trying to make a theological statement about Hashem and why he would lead us there. This isn't a midrash, it's a story by Agnon. But that, no, it's not that it's not a good idea to hang out there in Poland. Right? It might be a very good idea to be in Poland if being in Germany means you're going to be killed by the Crusaders. But wherever you're going to go in Galut, even if it's good now, even if the Jewish people are saved, or even if Yaakov and sons are saved in Mitzrayim by Paro and by Yosef, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to have a happy ending. So I think that's probably what, you know, Agnon is echoing here. Ve'amru isha re'yu hinei banu el eretz asher ba yashvu avotenu mikedem. Hachikarash ma Poland? Polin? Why is the place called Polin? Poland? Amra Knesset Israel efnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono shel Olam, im adayin lo higia sha'atei lehigael, migalut ze, shehi dome lelaila, Polin. Imanu ad sheta'alenu le'eretz Yisrael. So things were so good for the Jews in Poland, they say to Hashem, if if it's not yet time to bring us back to Eretz Yisrael, Hashem, if it's not time for you to bring us back to Eretz Yisrael, Po Lin Imanu, here, dwell with us. It's a play on words. I mean, it's a play on words that doesn't work in Polish, right? But Polin, in other words, in Hebrew or in Yiddish, it's called Polin, right? Polin, dwell here with us until Shtalenu le'Eretz Yisrael. So there's also something that Agnon is saying, Agnon, the great Zionist, right? That the idea that they were going to go to Eretz Yisrael on their own was, of course, inconceivable. And probably correctly so. Probably correctly so. Before 1700, the idea that Jews, in any type of organized way, are going to return to Eretz Yisrael, it's just not conceivable. And even then, it doesn't work very, very well. Even though there were always individuals that that went to Eretz Yisrael. But the idea of Zionism in its modern sense, of Aliyah in its modern sense, is not something that can be considered. The Jews in this regard are completely passive. And Po Lin, here we'll stay until Hashem will take us back to Eretz Yisrael. So, like all Agnonian texts, I don't know if anybody's done much reading of Agnon. It's a worthy investment. It's a worthy investment of your time. Agnon is translated into English, but you miss a lot because part of reading Agnon is unpacking all of the rimazim, all of the hints and echoes of biblical literature, of rabbinic literature. But I think that, this is what he's saying here. Melvin mentions the idea that Poland should be considered a stepping stone on the path to Eretz Yisrael, just like Egypt was. I think that's correct. The Abarbanel says something very much like that, although not about Poland. The Abarbanel does a scan of the different exiles of the Jewish people. The Jews were kicked out of Spain, they were kicked out of Portugal. After Spain, he goes to Portugal. After Portugal, they go to Italy. The Jews were kicked out of England, they're kicked out of France. He says it looks like, he's speaking then about the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, he says it looks like the Jews are being emptied out of Western Europe, and they're being pushed towards the East. That the whole thing is an attempt to empty out Europe piece by piece and move people towards Eretz Yisrael. Well, maybe that's the case. In Eastern Europe, in what we again kind of collectively call Poland, as opposed to Western Europe, there were fewer cities. Let's just look back at that map for a second. Here's Eastern Europe, here's Poland, here's Russia, the Pale of Settlements we have yet to talk about. The Pale of Settlement was like one giant ghetto of sorts, but that comes about later. That comes about in the 19th century. But most of us that raised their hand, most of us had a grandparent or great grandparent that lived someplace over here on the map. So in Eastern Europe, there were fewer cities. It was mostly villages. It was a much more agrarian society. So Jews were organized not into these ghettos, but into the shtetl. Although not all Jews lived in what we think of as the shtetl, kind of that image that we have. And again, maybe it's formed by watching Fiddler on the Roof too much, but not into ghettos. The shtetl is more like a self-imposed isolation. In the shtetl, Jews were they worked in trades. They were innkeepers. They were lumbermen. They were farmers. They were milkmen. They were dairy farmers. Again, if you don't have to have seen Shalom Aleichem, let's try to go to high culture. If you don't have to have seen Fiddler on the Roof, let's try to go to high culture. If you've read Shalom Aleichem, So you have a sense of what these things were. They weren't. They were able to move about freely, as opposed to the denizens of the ghettos in the West. But again, it was a type of de facto isolation. Jews stayed away from these. Again, I'm speaking in the voice of this character of Christians stayed away from the Jews, from, you know, this character that they saw as a Christ killer, and therefore it was a type of de facto self-government. Jews were just more isolated de facto, as opposed to de jure, as opposed to by the rule of law, but just by kind of the way things were. The Poles, by and large, you know, left them to themselves as long as the Jews pay their taxes. And therefore the organized Jewish community, the Kahal, has autonomy in the areas of its own concerns. Taxes go up and up and up in order to keep the Jewish community in business and to kick up the dues, as it were, to the non-Jews. So again, by the mid-18th century, there was great poverty. In Poland, each area was controlled by what was called the Puritz, who was a kind of count, you know, a lesser noble, who was given a certain area to control, and everybody that lived there had to kick up taxes, and he had to kick something up to the king, and generally the Puritzim, would extort the people that lived on his land in order to cover his own expenses. One of the major differences, and I guess with this we'll end for tonight, the major differences between Jews in the East and Jews in the West is that in the East, all of the Jewish communities were organized, at least from the 16th century on, into what was called the Vad Arba Artsot, the Council of the Four Lands. These were the Jews that lived in Poland, Volhynia, which is, I guess, what's northwest Ukraine today, White Russia, Belorussia, and Lithuania. And in 1527, these communities organized themselves into this kind of umbrella organization, the Vad Arba Artsot, and it flourished in the 16th and 17th centuries. It served as kind of like a high court of appeals. There were regular congresses of rabbinic leadership, of lay leadership. There were these semi-annual fairs, trade fairs, that would meet, and the meetings of the council would coincide with those fairs, when people would come together in one kind of central location anyway. Joel, do they still have those things? These kinds of big fairs that take place in the Polish countryside, and people come from all over?
I didn't understand the question, actually. Can you repeat it?
In other words, there was a feature in the medieval and early modern period of these fairs, these yuridim, where people from all the surrounding communities would come together, and it was a trade fair, and it was also something of a carnival or a circus. These are scenes that appear a lot also in Jewish literature from that time. Agnon himself.
But they don't have it anymore. I think that they probably end early in the 19th century.
I mean, it's similar, I guess. Sherry mentions like the country fair in America, but these would also become opportunities for the communities, the outlying communities, to gather together. And this Vad Arba Artsot would represent the Jewish community of all of these areas to the controlling Polish government, and that also, you know, would be in charge of monitoring the collection of taxes, etc. And this Vadarba Artsot lasts until the mid-18th century, when the Polish government revokes its power. The Vadarba Artsot controlled the pinkas. It was a type of register, a ledger that recorded all of the happenings in the communities. We have those pinkasim, those notebooks, as it were, those registers, and it's an important, it's a very important source of Jewish history for Eastern European Jewry. We will continue with one more discussion about life in the shtetl, what that was like. And we'll take a look at this Yiddish story by Avraham Reisen. If you haven't read it yet, read it. It's not a long read. Again, when you look at a piece of fiction, which is what it is, when you look at a piece of fiction, you're not looking at it as a historical document. But it might help you fill in a gap. If not historical details, then the spice and the spirit of the history of the period that you would somehow be lacking otherwise. People that did read the story and sent in a few thoughts obviously picked up on the question of the role of the woman, of the mother in the story, and what that says about the role of women in pre-modern society and women in the shtetl. That's all obviously true, but I think there's more going on in the story than this character of Zlote, of the mother, because I think that there's a lot to be said about the father in the story and the children as well, and what roles they're playing in the culture, what role the Jewish books are playing, and what the difference between Jewish books and Jewish learning is, and all those things. So take a look at the story. If you read it, read it again and think. Don't be distracted by you know, the question of the women's role. Also, don't be too anachronistic in reading too much of our own modern sensibilities about women's roles into the story. But also try to pick a little bit more under the surface and think about what is it saying about society in general. Don't be distracted only by the obvious question of the mother's role, which might jump right off the page at you. Think of what else is going on. No, obviously, it was one of his main points, but it's not the only point. If I say distract, in other words, don't be distracted. Sometimes, you know, if we wave lights and shoot cannons and wave red flags, you notice that. But sometimes that also distracts you from noticing other details that are sometimes painted with a finer brush. So we will continue next time. I will stay online if anybody has any questions.